This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, and today I'll be joined by Ashley Thornburg for our usual What's Happening segment on Thursdays. She'll also be interviewing Randy Hatzenbuehler about the big show at Medora this summer, of course, the main stage show there. We'll hear from our essayist Bruce Berg, and we'll also have a Dakota Date book from Merrill Pepcorn. But first, the UND Writers' Conference is underway. It continues through Saturday. The event features well-known authors who talk about their work, the craft and the art. It's a major undertaking for the university's English department, but it's also a labor of love. It is, after all, the 44th annual conference. Professor Crystal Alberts is one of the conference co-chairs.
The idea was to have people who write memoir or who create characters who are authors or artists, or also authors who are political and think about what it means to be an author in 21st century America and what the role of reading is. So those were some of the things that went into the theme.
And how about the authors that were here? We've got a couple from the South, at least. How did they play into this theme?
Well, I mean, obviously Dorothy Allison draws on personal experience, and so does Mary Jo Bang. But also Richard Bausch goes the opposite and doesn't draw on personal experience, but still talks about the role of the artist. So that's the reason that I selected them, and part of the reason I put them on the panel together, because I thought it would be for an interesting conversation. This is the great thing about panels, because we have authors being honest and with a sense of humor. And again, you know, hearing authors read is fantastic, but these panels are a chance for authors just to sort of open up and tell us a little bit about what it means to write and what it means to be them, and that's part of what the Writers' Conference is all about.
And how do you get these people up here? I mean, these are some significant names. Obviously, Tony Kushner is a world-class name in his own right.
Sure. We have a lot of support from UND, including President Kelly and Provost LaBelle, the College of Arts and Sciences, and North Dakota. We have support from the City of Grand Forks, the North Dakota Humanities Council, the North Dakota Council on the Arts. It's a strong tradition that's been going on for 44 years, and we're grateful to the region, particularly North Dakota and the City of Grand Forks and UND, for enabling us to be able to fund this great conference.
Well, having done it now for 44 years and having a literature department, how does this enrich that activity for the student? How does this improve the program?
Well, I'm a contemporary Americanist, meaning I studied literature after 1945. My students were here, and a lot of my students were here for the panel because I asked them to come. We read stuff in class prior to the Writers' Conference. So when it was mentioned Sonny's Blues was a great story, all of my students in the room had already read Sonny's Blues, even though I didn't know that Sonny's Blues was going to be discussed. So I saw them perk up a little bit. So I think it's great. There's no other chance like this in the country, really, to be an undergrad and just hang out with some of the biggest names in American literature. And I'm envious that I didn't get the chance. I didn't go to UND, so I didn't get the opportunity that they're getting.
Well, I noticed, keep Whopper John's memory alive, donate to the John Little Memorial Endowment today. I remember Whopper John. I remember the catfish stories, and of course, he started the conference, didn't he?
He started the conference. John Little started the conference in 1970, and as the story goes, he was, of course, from the South, from Mississippi, and he missed his friends. And so he brought up his friends, who are a bunch of Southern writers, so again, Dorothy and Richard are appropriate. And it was such a success that he just kept doing it. And there have been a number of directors and co-directors over the years, but we've managed to keep it going for 44 years. We've never missed, not even in 97 and not in 2009. So fingers crossed we'll be able to keep doing this for many years to come.
That's Professor Crystal Alberts. She and Heidi Serwick, the other conference co-chair, have a lot to keep track of. One of the daily features is the panel of conference authors talking about the work that goes into their art. In this panel, you'll hear Southern authors Richard Bausch and Dorothy Allison and poet Mary Jo Bang in a conversation moderated by UND English professor Adam Kitzes.
Censorship is when I grew up, a great play by Tennessee Williams was proscribed by the Catholic Church, and I was a devout Catholic, and I went and looked at the list of proscribed works, which is comprised about 90% of the world's literature, and I realized that I probably wasn't going to be Catholic much longer, at least not as it was then practiced. And for me, censorship is bad, even if what is being censored is in some societal way harmful. I just don't believe in it at all. I believe in free expression. And when I'm writing, I never think about it at all, ever. And I paid a price for it. My novel piece is full of language, and three different high schools have written me saying, we want to make it our assigned text for the senior classes. And I always write back and say, have you read the book? Please read the book before you make it an assignment, because I'm sure you're going to get some stuff from parents. And of course, in all three cases, immediately, oh, we're very sorry, we did read the book and we can't use it. But it's got language in it, but I wasn't about to change it. Those are soldiers, and they're about to be shot any minute. And I heard them talking. So I don't believe in it.
I've been dealing with it all my life. It seems to me that three quarters of who I am on some level crosses some line that somebody going to be pissed off about. And the books are going to be banned and the stories are going to piss people off and I'm going to get in trouble. I expect that. I take that as a given. If you're going to do serious work, you're going to run into serious opposition. I kind of like it. I love upsetting people. It's just my nature. But the thing that's sneaky is self-censorship. And it is sneaky. You don't always know what you're afraid of. You don't even always know that you're afraid. Or that your fear makes you bombastic, which is something we could probably also talk about. It's pitiful. Knowing yourself. Writing will teach you about yourself. I always tell young writers that, you know, that you need to kick that engine in. You got to get some passion going. So if at all possible, go where you're afraid. Break a sweat. It'll get you, it'll focus you. But it will also, by its nature, show you what you're really afraid of, the thing that's underneath the thing that you know you're afraid of. It seems to me that the biggest handicap I've faced was that I've always wanted to be thought of as smart. You know, because people like me, where I grew up, we were assumed to be dumb. Dumb, dumb, dumb. And if not dumb, if not stupid, then licentious and criminal. I could handle licentious and criminal. I couldn't handle being thought of as stupid.
And we're from the South, so our IQ goes down 10 points with anybody we're talking to from New England.
And the further north we move, Boy, it gets more unpleasant. You have to let go of some of that, because it will it'll steer your work in directions you don't want to go. If you're always trying to prove you're smart, how the hell are you going to write about most of your family? That's a self-censorship we rarely acknowledge. I mean, but talking about genuine humiliation, talking about shame, that level of censorship I constantly have to counter.
Yeah, I think that there's this, part of this is because we do want readers and we want approval. And very early as a poet, someone said, you can't have all the readers. And if you're writing something that everyone loves, it's probably not worth reading. And that was very, you know, anxiety-making. But over time, I have seen that that's true. That if you claim for yourself your right to do something in this particular way, there are always going to be people who move away from that. And I think that it's a badge of honor, ultimately, that this is what you do. And you're not going to be a conformist, because you wouldn't know anyway how to do it. You know, we think, oh, well, if I just wrote this kind of thing, then yes, the redneck zombie, that will be very successful. But that can fail too. So it's really good that we don't know what people want. And people don't know what they want until they're presented with it. And so that means that you can only fall back on yourself and your own compulsion to write in a particular way. And then you look around to see if you can't get permission for that by the fact that other people have done things their way, and they have been successful. So when I read Gertrude Stein, for instance, I was so excited. I thought, really? That's a poem? That could be a poem? Oh, my God. Anything can be a poem then. This is so exciting. You know, all those things I've wanted to do, Gertrude has shown me the way. Not that I'm going to do it her way. That wouldn't be fun. But I can do it my way because these people did it their way. So I think that it's a process. You just have to continue to talk to yourself and expose yourself to people who have done crazy things and been remembered for it. Those people who operate right there in the center, you know, they're not that different from the people on either side of them, and those aren't the people we tend to remember over time. So, you know, in poetry, we remember Emily Dickinson, who during her time, she would send these poems to somebody, Thomas Wentworth Higginson, and he thought, you know, the world's not ready for this, and he would just put them in a drawer. And it was only after her death and a lot of circumstances that he was willing to try to get those published. But, you know, you just keep doing it. You do it your way and try to find permission for that by the fact that others have done it their way.
An aspect of this, too, is that especially for, I think, for a storyteller, is because there are so many stories that can be reduced. You know, that old thing about the seven basic conflicts and all of that, it can freeze you up. It's a battle, really, when you're first starting to write and trying to find your way to arrive at yourself. If you can arrive at yourself, sometimes it isn't something that happens consciously. It's just something that, writing it over and over again, one of the things that you'll hear somebody say is, man, I wish I could have written that story. You know, Flannery O'Connor's A Good Man is Hard to Find. God, I wish I could have written that story. And the answer I have for that with students is, you arrive at yourself and you'll write a story that Flannery O'Connor would say, oh boy, I wish I could have written that. Because you can't be replicated or replaced. If you arrive at yourself, it's got to be the original thing. I think we're talking about the same thing, but a lot of times it's an almost a fumbling, at least it was for me, until I realized one day that I wasn't sounding like anybody else, and I thought, well, this must be how I sound, you know. And I didn't really want to be too conscious of it, because I think that's what happened to Hemingway. He got so conscious of it that he was parodying himself by the time he was 40.
Let's change gears a little bit. I've got a couple of questions, general questions, about what it's like to read your work over time. And also some specific questions about what it's like to see your work done in film adaptations. Bastard Out of Carolina being one, but if I'm not mistaken,
The Last Good Time was made into a film. Great cure for insomnia. If you ever sleepless, just get that film and watch it. You'll be asleep in 20 minutes.
That's sad. I just had the experience of I'm about to be an e-book. Skin is being redone as an e-book. And I wrote Skin. We published Skin almost 20 years ago, and a lot of the essays had been collected over a period of a decade before that. So some of these essays are 30 years old. And I had to write a new introduction for the media version. Okay, so first I read all the essays, and then I discover, boy, there's a bunch of stories here that I kind of like. But there are one or two of these clunkers that make no sense at all. At some point, we were fighting internecine, I might be mispronouncing that word, but I mispronounce most words, so let it go. We were doing all this political infighting, and everybody was talking in slogans. Do you remember that? You're young. You probably don't remember anything. But there was a point in which early feminists, particularly, were using a lot of language that, I swear to God, I'm reading these essays, and I think, I got to translate. And then I thought, it was of its time, and I'm going to look like a fool, and people are going to go, what? But then they're going to get to the story on page 4, because whenever I drop into story, I make sense. When I try to talk in political language and sloganeering or early feminist dialectic mode, it gets tedious and it doesn't quite make sense. But then I would drop into story and real people would walk across the page for a page and a half or 2 pages, and it would make sense. It was a revelation. It showed to me that with too much encouragement, I could be boring as hell. But with just a little attention paid to how real people move through the world, the prose can come alive again and make sense. And that's not a bad thing to have finally concluded. Some of those works show you who you were at a different time in your life.
That's author Dorothy Allison talking about her work, and that panel includes Richard Bosch and poet Mary Jo Bang. More from the UND Writers' Conference in a moment.
Support for this program is provided by the North Dakota Education Association, an organization of 8,000 school employees working to ensure great public schools for every child.
Tonight's television lineup on Prairie Public starts with a This Old House Hour, then at 8 Central, Doc Martin, and at 9, The Aviators, followed at 9:30 by Bluegrass Underground. Tune in tonight on Prairie Public.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. You just heard a little music from Triada, a guitar trio. Put together a CD called Triada, T-R-I-A-D-A. Well, we're going to hear more from our panelists, Southern authors Richard Bosch, Dorothy Allison, and Mary Jo Bang. Here we go to the UND Writers' Conference.
I was on the set of The Last Good Time, and the director said, "Oh, I'm glad you're here. The press kit is here. You can be interviewed." And he walked me up and introduced me to these three people with a camera. He said, "This is Richard Bosch. He wrote the novel we're filming here." And she said, "Oh, good." And she walked over to me, this young, very attractive, dark-haired journalist, television journalist. And she said, "I just want you to know." She took me aside and said, "I want you to know I love, love, love your work." And I never know what to do with my face in circumstances like that. I just went, "Oh." And she said, "I want you to know that you're responsible for the first existential thoughts I had in the fifth grade." And I realized she thought I was Richard Bach and had written Jonathan Livingston Seagull.
So, go with it. She was pretty.
So I was Richard Bach for 5 minutes. I didn't want to embarrass her. So I just stood there and said, "Yeah, I had a lot of fun writing that book." The seagull was originally an alligator. But it didn't work because he kept eating the other animals. So
it's a sin and a shame. I've had people come up to me and they said, "I loved your movie." I'm like, "That ain't my movie. That's Angelica Houston's movie. And it's a cinematic sepia-toned version of the South. It's strange as hell. But pieces of it are all right." But they never want to talk about the pieces. They don't ever want to get specific. It's odd to be in that kind of venue where they take your work and they actually take it like an outline of it and reproduce something that is sometimes scary, sometimes good, but it's sad. I can't watch that movie.
I liked the music.
The music ain't bad, you know. She did pretty good with that. And she's pretty good on violence. But it's really, really hard for Hollywood directors to understand the Southern working class sense of humor. And no, it's Yankees don't seem to understand the Southern working class sense of humor. However, having been in Grand Forks for 2 days, I think you get it. I think you people live in a state of constant adversity and temperature shifts that are equivalent to being raised in the South in a working class family.
I personally like to refer to this region as the Deep North.
Okay.
I don't know if that's any help.
Okay.
Did
you know how laughing out loud when you fall on the ice can save your life? This is exactly what happens in Bastard when the uncles roll a truck or somebody robs a grocery store. You understand the wonder and joy of life.
But do you ever feel anger at your ancestors who were coming across the plains? "Oh, well, let's stop here." Why? Why did you spoil? This is uninhabitable.
God, I bet you listen to James McMurtry a lot. You know his song, "Level Land"? We're landing the plane in Grand Forks, and I'm singing "Level Land." It's about them people that just stop as they're headed across the prairie.
Mm. "There's a bear. Let's quit."
Yep.
I think poets rarely, if ever, have a poem as the basis of a film. But I recently, and I, listening to you talk, the two of you, I think there's also this difficulty of taking one form and putting it into the other. So I recently did a translation of Dante's Inferno, and a ballet company wants to do a contemporary Dante's Inferno, and so they have engaged me as a consultant. I can't bear to have them not take my advice, you know, and I say, no, it should be this. And then the head of the company will say, well, but it's like, I just want to wash my hands of the whole thing because I don't have total control. And that's what we do when we create something. No, and we've been talking to you about how this is what only we can create. So you can imagine if we've created something that is a mirror of our interior, and then someone goes and starts messing with it, it's shocking. And I have been thinking, this is what it's like to have a novel made into a film, and I never want to have any part to do with
it. Folks, I've gotten the card, the one that reads, one last question. Which is too bad. This has been really fun.
But you got to pick the last question.
As a matter of fact, I didn't have a question so much as a request. I brought my copy of Elegy and requested if Mary Jo would find a poem that spoke to the theme of this panel and read it for us as a way of closing things off. And she has chosen Beneath the Din.
Beneath the din of voices bouncing off hard walls and window wall and tile surface on which feet two per person rest and chair legs four per chair rest, there is breath. Talk is to be human again. Silence is an escape page as white as a tablet of phenobarbital. There is no waking up from death. That's the pity. The dead leave what could be next unfinished. You left nothing left to say, and yet there is this incomplete labyrinth of finished thought, this wash of days over energy's uneven rock, this vault door's hollow closing crash behind which I say, stop to the accidental, uncle to the twisty wrist, eyes close to the insomnia hour. Then tomorrow merges with the present and becomes the possibility of the vacuumed after, where a snake makes its way back across a game table sea of emerald green leaves. The guest clouds circle and soak up the night, and all the ghosts go blank. Thank you. Nice.
That is poet Mary Jo Bang, and this afternoon she was interviewed in front of an audience by Jack Russell Weinstein, who, of course, is the host of Why, Philosophical Discussions about Everyday Life on Prairie Public Radio. And we look forward to hearing that conversation, which will be rebroadcast later this month. He's also handling the conversation with Tony Kushner, which is tomorrow night at 8 o'clock at UND's Chester Fritz Auditorium. And that, again, will be played back for our radio audience sometime in June. But that's a very big event. Tony Kushner, a Tony Award winner and a Pulitzer Prize winner, a very big deal. Well, coming up in the next block of our program, you'll hear Ashley Thornburg. She's going to conduct an interview about the Medora musical. Yes, the snow will melt, the sun will come out, and we will have something called summer. We just have to be a little patient. In the meantime, let's check in with the news. And Todd McDonald is standing by. What's up, Todd?
Hey, Doug. This afternoon, the North Dakota House has killed an overhaul, has killed a tax overhaul bill. That bill, introduced by Mandan Senator Dwight Cook, would close some oil tax loopholes, redefine so-called stripper wells, which are low-producing wells that are taxed at lower rates, and would, in 2017, lower the effective tax rate on oil from 11.5% to 9.5%. Montpelier Representative Craig Headland is a member of the House Finance and Taxation Committee, which gave the bill a do-not-pass recommendation.
Our committee believes that a solution and revision of this tax policy must be revenue neutral, and it must continue to serve the long-term best interest of North Dakota and our citizens. We understand the long-term vitality of the oil industry is essential to North Dakota's future. At this time, however, we have been unable to come to a consensus on Senate Bill 2336, that will allow us to achieve these goals.
The measure failed 87-6. Opponents of a bill to tighten voter identification requirements say it's a solution in search of a problem. The measure, which passed the House, would change state law so a voter can no longer sign an affidavit if the voter doesn't have proof of residency, such as a driver's license or utility bill. Supporters say under current law, the voter who casts a ballot after signing an affidavit will have that vote counted, and there's no way to retrieve that vote if there's a challenge to the voter. The new language would require a driver's license or state-issued ID, which could be obtained free of charge from the Department of Transportation. That free ID does not have to have a photo. Jim Silrum is Deputy Secretary of State. He told the Senate Government Affairs and Veteran Affairs Committee,
"The whole purpose of this bill is in no way, shape, or form to restrict anybody from voting. It is to say that everybody may vote, but they have to have an ID to vote, and these are the ways that they can obtain one."
Opponents say the law puts up barriers for the elderly and Native Americans. Josh Axvig represents AARP.
"And on behalf of older Americans who have largely shaped the values of our democracy, we urge great care to ensure that the basic right to vote is not undermined in an overbroad effort to address phantom allegations of voting abuse."
In the 2012 general election, more than 10,500 affidavits were signed. The committee has yet to take action. And an updated flood forecast from the National Weather Service shows a 50% chance the Red River in Fargo could hit 38.1 feet this spring. Fargo says it's well prepared to handle that, but sandbags will be needed to shore up levees in other low-lying areas. City Administrator Pat Zavril says the city will need about 500,000 sandbags. That's in addition to another 750,000 filled sandbags in reserve. Moorhead City Manager Mike Redlinger says the city has no concerns if the river tops 38 feet. At that level, Redlinger says, only 7 property owners would need to build flood protection. From the Prairie Public Newsroom, I'm Todd McDonald.
Welcome back to Main Street. I'm Ashley Thornburg, and it may not look like it, but it is a good time to start making summer plans. And a popular place to visit is, of course, Medora. In fact, it is the number one vacation destination in North Dakota. And it's the subject of a new slogan: Explore It, Adore It, Medora. And so we thought we would talk about just all what is there to explore and, of course, to adore in Medora. And I am joined right now by Suzanne Wentz, who is the marketing director of the Theodore Roosevelt Medora Foundation. Suzanne, thanks for joining me today.
Thank you for having me, Ashley.
And it sounds like you guys have a lot going on this summer.
We certainly do. It's been very, very busy as we make plans to prepare for, you know, for the 2013 season. And we've been busy in the marketing department, definitely developing this new campaign and theme. You already named it, the Explore It, Adore It, Medora. It's been actually a lot of years since the Medora Foundation has launched a new campaign. The public might remember some of them over the years, the Rough Rider Country. And actually, the most recent was almost a decade ago with the Spend a Day in Medora. And what we've found is over the last several years, Medora has really grown and evolved into something different. And so although the Spend a Day was applicable to that time, it was time to really come up with a few short words that painted a better description of what the travelers might experience when they come to Medora.
Well, it certainly sounds like there's more than just a day's worth of activities out there.
There definitely is. We have lots going on out there. And that's actually how the campaign came to fruition, was, you know, really listening to our travelers. When I go to the different conferences and the public events, I always like to ask folks what it is that they enjoy in Medora. And what I found, Ashley, is that it's different for everyone. Some of them enjoy grabbing onto the handlebars and going down with their bike on the Matahe, or golfing at Bully Pulpit, or enjoying the Medora Music Hall. But the one thing that they all have in common when I ask them if they enjoyed their time there, they say that they all love it. And so it really condensed down into a very short phrase, Explore It, Adore It, we thought would be a really great campaign for Medora.
Well, let's start with exploring a little bit more, probably the most famous one, and that is, of course, the Medora Musical. And the big thing this year is starting at a different time.
It is, and we are very, very excited about that, Ashley. We're heading into our 49th season, And this is the first time in history that we made the decision to make this change. And it's come with really overwhelming support from the folks that do know about it. And it really is a family-friendly change. We moved it up 1 hour. So those of you that have been out there for a lot of years, it's been at 8:30 p.m. Mountain Time, which can get quite late for those that might travel from a central time zone. So it will be at 7:30 p.m. Mountain Time every night throughout the summer from June 7th to September 7th. And that'll allow people some time to maybe head down the hill and into downtown Medora and enjoy some of the activities that might still be going on after the show.
And auditions for the show have already wrapped up, right? So you have the cast?
We have the cast, and I haven't even been told who the cast is.
Oh.
But I know. I know.
There goes my next question.
I know. Sorry about that. So I'm really excited to, you know, to be able to visit with you again when we announce the cast. I do know that we have three variety acts. I just got the news on that today, and we're not ready to share that yet, but we're excited. I can tell you two of the acts are brand new. They've never been out to Medora before. And one is we're going to welcome back a comedian that that everybody loved in North Dakota. So we're really excited. So, you know, stay tuned. We'll be announcing that in the near future, too.
All right. Well, let me ask you this, and hopefully you do know about this, the Teddy Talent Trek.
Yeah, the T.R. Roosevelt.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Recently, a campaign was held, and the vocal competition winner gets to actually perform sort of a guest vocal performance during the musical.
You know what? You're teaching me, Ashley. I didn't even know that. I apologize. That's wonderful. I'm glad to hear that. We always love to welcome, local talent out to the musical. It's a great experience. I have a daughter myself that's a singer, and she aspires. She's 13, and she can't wait till she is old enough to try out to be a Burning Hills singer. So, I thought maybe you were referring to the TR Salute with our professional actor that's coming back this summer, Theodore Roosevelt.
Well, yeah, we can certainly talk about that. This is kind of an opportunity to get to know more than just the presidential Roosevelt, right?
That is definitely true. We welcome back Joe Wiegand, is a professional actor, a repriser of Theodore Roosevelt, and he does an amazing job. In fact, Randy Hudson-Buehler had the opportunity to meet him at the White House when he was performing for George and Laura Bush, and what would have been TR's Theodore Roosevelt's 150th birthday. And we had him in Medora last summer, and he does a show that's called A Teddy Roosevelt Salute to Medora. And he's been traveling around actually all year representing not only Theodore Roosevelt, but Medora, and trying to encourage people all over the country to come to North Dakota and not only visit all the sites in North Dakota, but visit Medora as well. So we're really excited to welcome him back this summer, too.
Well, speaking of those sites, there are lots of other things, of course, to do in Medora. And one thing I just read that Golf Digest just rated the Bully Pulpit Golf Course as one of America's most fun courses.
You are correct. We are very proud of that and very excited. It was ranked one of America's 100 greatest public golf courses. And Kathy and Casey have been extremely busy out there getting everything prepared. The course is looking great. The water's looking fantastic. And we have a lot of golfers that are anxious to start booking tee times. And we typically open, you know, that first or second week in April. Not for sure yet, but it's looking really good so far.
So is it safe to assume then that the course is fully recovered from that flood that hit it a couple years ago?
You know what? That's a great question. And in fact, it has. And those avid golfers that golfed it before the flood and now after last summer have said we had to change a little bit of one of the holes. They said it's actually more beautiful and magnificent than it was before. So it's made a full recovery and then some.
Well, that worked out well.
That worked out well. A little hard getting there, but...
Now, you mentioned this at the top of the interview here, the Matahay Trail. Matahay is a Mandan Indian phrase that means an area that has or will be around a long time. I think that definitely describes that area. There is some really rough terrain around there, but it was actually featured in Trail Runners magazine.
That is true. And, you know, I have to admit, I have not explored the Mata-Hate Trail myself, even though I've traveled to Medora for years. That kind of goes along with there's so much to see and do. I have to get out there and do more. But each year I know we have a Badlands Trail Run in September, and a lot of people enjoy running the trails, riding horseback out there, along with biking or walking as well. So it's a beautiful area, and I'm definitely going to commit to doing that this summer.
I got tired even just reading the article. The trail sounds really difficult.
I don't think it's for the faint of heart, for sure. So
agreed. Well, now, what about with all the changes going on in the western half of the state with the oil boom and everything, what can visitors expect? Are there any delays? Do they need to get camping spots right away? What can you expect for that?
You know, I'm really glad you asked that question, Ashley. No, you cannot. You don't need to worry about any delays. We actually have quite a few rooms available most days in Medora, as does Dickinson and Belfield. We've done very well there. You know, of course, the typical holiday weekends and, you know, the peak of the summer in July, or the 4th of July events, things like that, you're going to want to book your space for the campground or the hotels ahead of time. But we've had great availability, and certainly please do not let that discourage you from, you know, from planning ahead, but definitely coming on out and seeing us in Medora.
And now you've got the new campaign, Explore It, Adore It, Medora. You have a new website that's supposed to help people plan their trip to Medora a little bit more easily.
Yep.
What's next for the foundation?
Well, you know, if I could touch on the website, that is huge, and I am so excited for the public to jump on there and take a peek. The My Medora function on that, as a mother, I love planning trips ahead of time, and the My Medora function allows you to go in and pick all the activities that your family might want to do while you're there for the day, and email that agenda to Grandpa and Grandma, or print it out for yourself. There's a Google map that's attached to it. Not like Medora is huge, but you'll know exactly where you're going while you're out there. And there's also a neat feature, Ashley, that's brand new on the homepage, and it's the Instagram. Not sure, you're probably more familiar with that than I am, but that's something different for our website, where travelers, when they're out there, can take their own photos and hashtag Medora, and it feeds right into our homepage, so you can actually see Medora through the eyes of a traveler and what they're enjoying. So we're really, really excited about the website. You know, just lots of activities going on. Maybe see some new events. We're not quite ready to announce them yet, but we're going to try some different things in Medora this summer, and it's just a great community, and I hope everybody comes out to see us.
All right, keeping us a little bit in suspense.
I know. Sorry about that.
Suzanne, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you for having me, Ashley.
Bruce Berg is next.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. And every now and then, Bruce Berg throws us an essay, and this one is entitled Lists, and it's about the way lists can change.
A decade ago, I asked Matt Olin for a list of his favorite films. Matt kindly complied with my wish by giving me the names of movies that would make many a classic list. A Man for All Seasons, The Wild Bunch, both Godfather films, Citizen Kane, If, Death in Venice, Napoleon, North by Northwest, All Quiet on the Western Front, Lawrence of Arabia. I included Matt's list in a book I was doing on commentaries and Prairie Public employee profiles. At that time, I would have matched Matt's list with my own, which would feature The Best Years of Our Lives, On the Waterfront, José Ferrer's Cyrano de Bergerac, Alec Guinness's Tunes of Glory, Yul Brynner and Kay Kendall's Once More with Feeling, The Sundowners, and so on. However, my question today is not so much what we once liked, but what changes would we make to our list? I call it the Captain's Table Syndrome, or what films have fallen into disfavor with us? Films that we once thought good or even classic, Some years ago, I saw an English film called The Captain's Table with John Gregson and Nadia Gray. I unabashedly hooted and howled throughout the entire picture. I thought it was marvelous. Now, many years later, I saw the film again, and I could muster nary a smile. What happened? Did I grow up or get duller or learn something about films? I'm not sure, but the movie was the same, but I wasn't. It reminded me of the movie that I saw in high school, David Lean's Breaking the Sound Barrier. I thought it was terrific. I saw the flick 10 years later, and I couldn't believe that I thought it a good film. Cliché-ridden, corny, same film, different person. Now, some films haven't received critical acclaim, but we love them nevertheless. I first saw King Solomon's Mines in 1951, and I can't count the number of times I repeat and I look at it again and again. Same thing with The Magnificent Seven, which I saw in 1960. I never seem to get tired of that movie. Films from the 1940s, The Bishop's Wife, Rachel and the Stranger, Arsenic and Old Lace, they're just favorites. I should give them Oscars of my own making. Small wooden statues with just a dab of gold paint for the shine they give to me. Now, books have been written about the movie that changed my life. My thought today centers on the movies that failed to make the trip with us as we changed, and those that stay fresh and exciting, the ones that have staying power. Which ones are on your lists? This is Bruce Berg, Jamestown.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public, and we're going to go find out what's happening next.
Support for this program is provided by Basin Electric Power Cooperative of Bismarck, producing reliable electricity. Basin Electric operates generation stations in North Dakota, South Dakota, and Wyoming, including wind farms in North and South Dakota.
Arts programming on Prairie Public is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, a state agency developing, promoting, and supporting the arts in North Dakota.
It's Thursday. It's time for Ashley Thornburg and I to chew over the ideas that we have seen in the papers, online, stuff that's sent to us. We've gone through piles of material to come up with what we think is pretty interesting about what's happening out there. So what did you come up with?
I'm going to start with an event right away this evening at Concordia College in Moorhead, specifically at the Knutson Center. It starts at 7:30, and this is the opportunity to hear a reading from Louise Erdrich. She is the 2012 National Book Award winner in fiction. And also going to be there is Domingo Martinez. He is the 2012 Book Award finalist. And these book awards, they'll be on campus. There will be readings and conversations. And it will be hosted by NPR's Neil Conan.
Wow. Pretty special.
Check it out tonight at 7:30.
And our apologies to those who listen to our programs rebroadcast at 7 o'clock.
I couldn't pass this one up.
No, it's pretty good. And I can't pass this one up. Author Melanie Hoffert. We had her on our program a while back. She'll be at Bismarck State College this evening for a reading from her book, Prairie Silence, a memoir. The 8 p.m. reading and book signing is free to the public. It'll be held in the Basin Auditorium in the Bismarck State College National Energy Center of Excellence. Originally from Winemere, Hoffert is a graduate of Concordia in Moorhead, so lots of connections here today. With an MFA from Hamlin, she now lives in Minneapolis. Her book, Prairie Silence, a memoir, was published by Beacon Press. So we've got UND's Authors Conference. We've got Concordia doing stuff. We've got Bismarck State College. What else?
That's a literary weekend,
I would say.
Also in Bismarck, this is the final weekend to check out the Spitfire Grill presented by Dakota Stage. This is a sweet, soulful, southern musical. It's supposed to be fun and family. family friendly, and it is about an eatery that raffles itself off, struggling in the economy, and the winner is the best essayist. So very interesting concept, I think, for a theatrical performance, and that is running at 7:30 p.m. through Saturday, and then there is a 2 p.m. show on Sunday as well.
Well, the complete world of sports abridged. That's Sports on Our Minds and on the Stage Saturday night at the Hanson Theater. That's in the Roland Dill Center for the Arts at Minnesota State Moorhead. The Reduced Shakespeare Company presents the complete world of sports abridged. Again, the main event kicks off at 7:30. Tickets range from $12 to $28 for the complete world of sports abridged at MSUM this Saturday.
Well, let's keep up with that sports theme here. Two chances to see some former Harlem Globetrotters. The first one here is in Williston on Saturday. You get the chance to see Meadowlark Lemon. He is the clown prince of basketball. And Hollywood Brown, they're going to be putting on a show. Meadowlark's Comedy All-Stars versus the Crime Stopper All-Stars. And this benefits the Williston Police Department and the Crime Stoppers program. And tickets are $10 or $15 at the gate. And you can also check them out at in Minot on Sunday at the Minot State University Dome. And that is at 4 p.m. And that time it benefits the local Minot firefighters.
Ah, well, the Fargo Public Library welcomes Sonic Escape, a New York City-based flute, violin, cello trio, to the downtown main library. That's Sunday for a concert that starts at 2 o'clock in the community room. This trio of Juilliard graduates will present a diverse offering of classical and original music and music styles from around the world. The concert is free and open to the public.
And you know what? They are also performing at 7:30 on Saturday on the 23rd at the Denault Auditorium in Jamestown. I'm not going to re-describe them because you did a good job with that, but do go check them out if you have the opportunity in Jamestown. Tickets there are $15, and they are available through the Jamestown College box office.
Junie B. Jones is going to be presented at UND's Chester Fritz Auditorium Sunday afternoon at 2 o'clock. Little kids musical, Hooray, Hooray! TheaterWorks USA is making a brand new musical, and it's about Junie B. Jones. It's based on a bunch of books that Barbara Park wrote about Junie B. and the things she does in first grade. So family fare there. $16 for the tickets. You can get four for $50. That, again, is 2 o'clock on Sunday at Chester Fritz.
Check out The Ringers on March 22nd at 7:30 at the Arts Center in Jamestown. This is the area's newest blues band, but not new musicians. Veteran players here, Mike Jenkins, Ken Gilbertson, Keith Johnson. It's really great. Go check them out at the 22nd, 7:30 Arts Center in Jamestown.
Well, I hope I don't butcher the name terribly, but Ilya Uakushev is a winner of the 2005 World Piano Competition. He's performed at major venues on three continents, and he will be at the Dickinson State University Saturday at 7:30 in the evening at the Dorothy Stickney Auditorium. And that's $20 for the concert ticket or $55 for six if you are a member of the Dorothy Stickney Auditorium. Or the concert series, I should say, the Dickinson Area Concert Association. So 7:30, I don't want to garble this too much, Ilya from Russia, Saturday 7:30 at DSU.
Those names do get very tough. I think I am going to go ahead and go to my event of the week, and that is coming up on Saturday, Tracy Morgan, the very, very funny comedian, putting on a show called Excuse My French. So that should tell you right away for mature audiences.
The stuff
only
he couldn't say on 30 Rock.
Right. He will be performing at the Fargo Theater. Doors open at 6. The show starts at 7. There are still tickets available, and they are at $47.50. And I have it on good authority that he might end up on the Walk of Fame, putting his hands in there. I know they're efforting it, so.
All right. Well, that'll be cool. Well, here's mine. Celebrate with the students and faculty of the newly named North Dakota State University School of Music. The inaugural gala concert is Sunday afternoon at 2 o'clock in NDSU's Festival Concert Hall. It is free and open to the public. It features the award-winning NDSU Concert Choir and Wind Symphony. And following the performance, you can Get a free dessert reception. If you're interested in attending, please register at ndsu.edu/fine arts. That's the inaugural gala concert for the new North Dakota State University School of Music at 2 o'clock on Sunday. And that's what's happening. Dakota Datebook is next.
This is Dakota Datebook for March 21st. On this date in 1931, Swede Risberg's name showed up in a Bismarck Tribune newspaper article about a car accident near Harvey. One of the drivers, Pierce Scott, died when he was thrown from his vehicle. Charles Swede Risberg was among the others involved in the accident who received minor bruises, and he was identified as a former Major League Baseball star. Swede Risberg was indeed a former player, but his star had been tarnished by the infamous Black Sox scandal. The scandal involved the 1919 World Series between the Cincinnati Reds and the Chicago White Sox, in which 8 White Sox players conspired with gamblers to throw the series in return for a promised big payoff. Word of the fix leaked out, and the 8 White Sox players, including shortstop Risberg, were barred for life from professional baseball, becoming forever blemished as the Black Sox. So how did Swede Risberg come to North Dakota? Risberg was a rangy 6-footer out of San Francisco who had reached the big leagues at age 22 and played only 3 seasons for the White Sox before being banned in 1921. Baseball was his only real skill, so Swede Risberg became a vagabond, playing in semi-professional leagues to make a living. Risberg played in Hibbing, Minnesota in 1922 and in Rochester, Minnesota from 1923 to 24. He played for a Scobey, Montana ball club for the 1925 season and then bounced around from Minnesota to South Dakota to Manitoba before joining Jamestown's semi-pro team in 1921 under the leadership of manager O.K. Butts. Swede Risberg was a strong drawing card for Jamestown because of his fame, and fans got to see a major league talent on the local diamond. Risberg played in Jamestown for 2 seasons, and the team had great success. In 1930, Risberg had a .443 batting average as Jamestown won 37 games, losing just 16. Risberg lived in Jamestown with his wife Mary. After the 1931 car accident, Swede Risberg moved away to Sioux Falls for 2 years, and he eventually drifted west to California to operate a tavern. Risberg died in 1975 at the age of 81. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Dr. Steve Hoffbeck. I'm Errol Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from the North Dakota Humanities Council.
Well, just enough time to tell you what's coming up on Main Street on Friday. John Zemirek is, well, he's described as a rare bird because he is a sharp-tongued Catholic humorist who loves and defends the church, and he will join us to share his observations on the very recent election of the new Pope, Pope Francis. Also, news director Dave Thompson is a regular on Fridays to mull over the week's activity and the headlines and maybe give us a hint of what's coming up. There's certainly lots happening in Bismarck. Guest film reviewer tomorrow, we'll have Tony Tilton talking about the new movie The Incredible Burt Wonderstone, which has a lineup of stars you wouldn't believe, but we'll see how good the movie is. In the meantime, you have a great evening.